From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The history of Western imperialism has been told not only in textbooks, but with love and horror on the silver screen. Movies like The Man Who Would Be King, Gunga Din, even Apocalypse Now have portrayed the allure, the glory, and the pitfalls of imperial reach. In a helter-skelter world, some American voices are explicitly arguing it's time to create a new imperial order. Tonight, what the movies tell us about the glory days of imperialism. We begin with a look at the U.S. military buildup at the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. The tiny Persian Gulf nation will likely become the operational center of any U.S. attack on Iraq. I spoke with the Christian Science Monitor's Nicholas Blanford in Kuwait City and asked him to describe the latest signs that the U.S. is moving to a war footing in the region.
The signs on the ground are actually quite limited. There's been a lot of speculation of a buildup for some time now of troops and personnel. The Al Udeid base, which is under construction, is a $1.4 billion base about 20 miles outside Doha, the capital of Qatar. This has been seen as an alternative operational base for an attack on Iraq to the Prince Sultan base, which is the largest U.S. base in the Gulf region, which is in Saudi Arabia. And the Saudi government has had some misgivings over allowing the Americans to use the bases on Saudi soil for launching an attack against Iraq.
And we heard last week from the Pentagon that 600 or so members of the Central Command currently in Florida that has responsibility for the Iraq region will be moving to Qatar and to the Al Udeid Air Base in November formally for military maneuvers or exercise.
Yes, that's right. We were told that they were going to move there for this biennial military exercise. But it seems now that there's a very strong possibility that they will be there on a permanent basis. The idea being that if it comes to the crunch and a strike against Iraq is ordered, that there is always another base, another option to the Prince Sultan base in Saudi Arabia if the Saudis, for one reason or another, refuse to allow the U.S. to operate from there.
What is the scale of the Al Udeid base in Qatar? Is it sufficiently large to be the home base for a U.S. invasion of Iraq?
I think that's the idea. It's got a runway of 15,000 feet. It's the longest runway in the Middle East. To actually get there on the ground is very difficult. The security around there is quite tight. One is not allowed to get close to the perimeter fence, although from the main highway, which is about a mile away from the base itself, you can make out several very large transport aircraft there, and you can make out there's a huge strengthened hangar, which is supposed to be protected against nuclear, biological, and chemical attacks.
In a transfer of material from the U.S. base in Saudi Arabia to this base has already begun, is that correct?
Yes, they've been upgrading or increasing the rate of construction on the base for several months now, and they have transferred communications and intelligence equipment from Prince Sultan Base to Al Udeid. And they're supposed to be bringing in more hardware, if not personnel, to finish construction. I think by the end of the year they're hoping to get it wrapped up.
Nicholas Blanford, with all the obvious unease that we've seen in the Middle East about being associated with a U.S. war effort in Iraq, why is Qatar such an apparently hospitable base for U.S. operations?
Well, Qatar is a very small country. It has a population of around 750,000 people, and they view themselves as surrounded by much more powerful and larger states, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Iraq. And they've made a strategic choice some time ago to develop not just a military relationship, it's also a commercial relationship with the United States. And they feel that they can relax a little bit when they know that the U.S. is looking after them. So to this extent, they've been quite happy to allow the transfer of equipment from Prince Sultan to Al Udeid base and for increased rate of construction at the Air Force base when their neighbors in Saudi Arabia were expressing some unease about allowing their bases to be used for a strike against Iraq. And, of course, the whole debate of the U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries as well is an extremely sensitive issue.
You've written, Nicholas Blanford, that Qatar shares the largest known gas reserve in the world beneath the Persian Gulf with Iran, and that they have some fear that if it were not for an association with the United States, Iran might be tempted to make moves on those resources.
This was an example of the potential threat that Qatar might face. I'm not sure that this is a very realistic or high-profile concern of the Qataris, but it was given as an example that perhaps if the American military presence wasn't there in Qatar, then there was always the potential for these sort of problems to exist with their more powerful neighbors.
So with all that, the base seems to be expanding, and there may be a lot more U.S. troops and certainly military brass there soon. Nicholas Blandford, you're also based in Kuwait City and watching what's happening from that vantage. What's the response of Kuwaitis been to the increasing tempo of the drumbeat for war?
The Kuwaiti reaction is perhaps a little different from other countries in the Gulf and Arab countries in general. They're very conscious of the potential Saddam Hussein has for causing mischief in the region. And, of course, Kuwait was invaded in August of 1990 by Saddam Hussein, and memories are still very fresh of that time. The general feeling, I think, in Kuwait is that Saddam must go, and people on the street will be quite open about this. It's a very strong military presence of between 8,000 and 10,000 troops.
Mm-hmm.
And they view that, again, like the Qataris, as a sort of a guarantee for Kuwaiti sovereignty, as a bulwark against the possibility of Saddam Hussein launching some sort of attack against Kuwait. But at the same time, they're also extremely uneasy at harboring such large amounts of American personnel on their soil, given the distrust of Washington's Middle East policies.
Sounds like, then, support, but unease at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's really quite schizophrenic. There's been a sort of increase in the Islamic tendency in Kuwait over the last 10 years, and this tendency does not tend to support U.S. policies at all in the Middle East, deeply suspicious of the presence of Americans in the Gulf. Yet at the same time, they acknowledge that, well, you know, we need the Americans here because, frankly, Saddam is worse. So there is this sort of a bit of a dichotomy and contradiction in the thinking of many Kuwaitis over the American presence here.
And so the preparations go on. Nicholas Blandford, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Nicholas Blandford is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Kuwait City. Pick up the white man's burden, said Rudyard Kipling. And an America that is much more than white is eyeing that burden again today. Far-flung interventions, dreams of a world remade, and an echo, explicit and unabashed, in circles close to power, of the age of imperialism, a word that takes us back to the turn of the century, conquests in Africa and the Far East, to adventures in the Khyber Pass.
The only way to get there is through Afghanistan. Kafiristan? No. Two white men on their own would be cut to pieces before they went 5 miles into the Khyber Pass.
Just suppose we managed it. And suppose we got across the Afghan plains. Then what?
There's the Hindu Kush, a frozen sea of peaks and glaciers. A party of geographers, a mapping expedition tried several years ago and vanished into thin air. No white man has ever been there and come out since Alexander.
Alexander who?
Alexander the Great, King of Greece, about 300 years before Christ.
Well, if a Greek can do it, we can do it.
Tonight we're looking at imperialism through its rich and checkered Hollywood legacy. What can Gunga Din, Lawrence of Arabia, and the remake of Four Feathers, due out tomorrow, remind us of lessons learned in Blood and Fortune? Has the world changed? Or are we still drawn to the trumpets of imperial power? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is our On Point movie maven, Garen Daly, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Garen.
Hi, Tom.
Good to have you with us. And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Garen.
Hey, Jack.
So here we are. We're headed off into the imperial badlands, the wild, the exotic. We had Sean Connery there speaking with a fictional Kipling and the man who would be king. If one Greek can do it, that's
certainly... Two Englishmen
can take over the mythical Kafiristan somewhere northwest east of Afghanistan. Garen Daly, we've got a new movie coming out tomorrow that's all about ruffles and flourishes and pith helmets and the glory and savagery, the bright and the dark of imperialism. But what about this Hollywood endless fascination? I mean, it is perhaps one of the most photogenic subjects, genres out there. You've got Khyber Pass, you've got mountains, you've got battle, you've got it all.
Well, it's basically a male-dominated thing. It's action films, and that's what I think is the main... Hollywood. It's action, and you've got really black and white issues that are being developed. You've got supposedly a good situation and a bad situation. And with imperialism, I think one of the things that, you know, the politicians try to do is create a black and white situation. We're going in there to help the people. We're going to go in there and conquer for strategic reasons. We're doing it for God and country. And imperialism and in the films, those are easy things to etch out on a big canvas.
Brand new film coming out tomorrow. The Four Feathers, and this has been remade again and again and again.
Yeah, there's seven versions, the best version being the 1939 version with Ralph Richardson and directed by Zoltan Korda. This new version is directed, interestingly enough, by an Indian guy named Shakar Kapoor, who did Elizabeth. He's a very talented director, and I find a great deal of interest when I'm watching this film that here is a guy who was in India, which when he was born in 1945 was controlled by the British, and now he's making a film about British imperialism in Africa.
Maybe so, but the New York Times says it's balderdash, it's falderall, it's all the old infatuation with the trappings of imperial domination.
And they're right. It's not, and it's also not that good of a film. You don't get the payoff that you really, really want. In a film like Four Feathers, what you're looking for is a man is accused of cowardice. He's given four feathers of cowardice. He needs to try and develop himself and redeem himself. In the film, you don't get that. You don't get that redemption. But what you do get is you end up seeing some really wonderful set pieces. You get to see some of the arrogance that the British people had towards the natives who they were going
after. This is Sudan in this case.
This is Sudan in this place. And interestingly enough, you know, a really good actor by Djiman Hansan, who was in Amistad and Gladiator, takes the black man's burden, where he gets a dumb Englishman and teaches him how to live in the desert, how to work in the desert, and how to survive. And he ends up rescuing him time and time again. You wonder how the British were able to control so much of the world when they had to be taught so much by the natives.
Why are you protecting me?
God put you in my way. I have no choice. God.
An Englishman and a Christian. We must have done something terrible to offend him.
You laugh like an Englishman.
How does an Englishman laugh?
A scene from the seventh remake of The Four Feathers coming out tomorrow, Imperialism. Even now, 2002, back on the big screen. Jack Beatty, what is it about this that keeps it coming back and back? And what is it that we can learn from the cultural memory in some Hollywoodized degree trapped on the screen in these films?
Well, first on the context, Danny and Peachy, Michael Caine and Sean Connery, we heard in the first bit, mm-hmm. were part of the 70,000 mercenary European army, largely Irish, who, along with 6,000 British officials, ruled 300 million Indians in 1890. They were part, Danny and Peachy were, of a movement called imperialism. The word was coined in the 1870s.
From the Khyber Pass to Burma.
It came into general usage in the 90s, and between about 1875 and 1914, one quarter of the world's surface was carved up as colonies by six states. Britain took 4 million square miles. We ourselves took 100,000. And, you know, the reasons, why this, why then? I mean, Lenin, in a famous pamphlet, said that imperialism was the latest stage of capitalism, that the search for markets and so on drove the European powers to go abroad. And there was a lot to that, because central to this was rubber, tin, copper, oil, bananas. There was another part to it, too, and that was the part that Cecil Rhodes got to when he said that unless we have imperialism, we're going to have civil war in our country. This was a way to get rid of the working class, send them abroad, and they wouldn't create problems at home. But at the center of it was a kind of racial arrogance, and it just a sense of racial superiority.
We'll come back and look at that and at the films. We're talking about imperialism on the silver screen. What makes movies about world-straddling imperialism such a guilty pleasure? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about imperialism, Hollywood's imperialism, on the silver screen, Hollywood on the ambition and overreach, the grandeur and the gore of the great age of imperialism, its beginnings and its end. Are we moving back to ruffles and flourishes and Kipling's white man's burden? And what have we remembered and what have we forgotten about the glories and costs of ruling the world? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by our movie maven, Garen Daly, by our news analyst, Jack Beatty. Here is an example of America playing in the imperialist game, Teddy Roosevelt being depicted in The Wind and the Lion.
Did you yourself participate in stopping the bear, Mr. President?
Yes, I regret to say.
Why do you regret, Mr. President?
Because he's a fine creature. The American grizzly bear is a symbol of the American character. Strength, intelligence, ferocity. A little blind and reckless at times, but courageous beyond all doubt. And one other trait that goes with all previous.
And that, Mr. President?
Loneliness. The bear lives out his life alone, indomitable, unconquered, but always alone. He has no real allies, only enemies, but none of them are as great as he.
You feel this might be an American trait?
Certainly. The world will never love us. They respect us. They may even grow to fear us. They will never love us. But we have too much audacity. And we're a bit blind and reckless at times, too.
Teddy Roosevelt, depicted there on the Imperial America as a great grizzly bear in The Wind and the Lion. What movie moment defines imperialism for you? The triumphs of the Thin Red Line or Brando, Upriver, and The Horror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, Wind and the Lion. Sean Connery back again. He fits right into these imperial films.
It sounds like Sean Connery, but actually that's Brian Keith.
But isn't Sean Connery in Wind and the Lion?
Yes, forgive me. Of course, he plays the Razzouli. You're absolutely right. The Moroccan bandit who kidnaps an American woman. Actually, it was an American man in reality. And this, of course, is the turn of the century American imperialism, famously exemplified by President McKinley, who, when asked why we were taking the Philippines from Spain, replied, to Christianize the natives. Of course, they'd been Catholic for 450 years. The American empire was and especially the war in the Philippines, was among the most ignoble chapters in our history. We killed something around 200,000 Filipinos. Bullets come in there. People like Mark Twain and William James formed the Anti-Imperialist League and demonstrated and sort of try to speak to the conscience of the country. Mark Twain wrote a famous piece about how the Americans had tricked Aguinaldo, the leader of the Philippine Rebellion, into surrendering by putting up a white flag. And he said this was just treachery of Benedict Arnold proportions. So it was one of the most shameful passages in our history.
And Garen Daly, the arc of imperialism's portrayal in Hollywood terms, beloved for the ruffles, flourishes, and the exotic scenery, but it's very often not been predicted as the grand escapade.
Yeah, you know, I go back to one of my favorite films that I loved when I was a kid, Gunga Din. I just loved this film. It was a great action film. Cary Grant was wonderful. Douglas Fairbanks, Victor McLaughlin, directed by George Stephen, 1939. And I just absolutely adored the action. I see it about 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm like looking at it in a whole different light, because now all of a sudden the thuggy guru is really he's fighting for the liberation of his own people.
But he's the bad guy in Gunga Din.
He's the bad guy in Gunga Din. But if you listen to what his words, the script by and the production by George Stevens, make him a much more intelligent, much more liberator of the people than you could possibly imagine.
I see it in your faces. Who is this ugly little savage to snarl so boldly at the British lion? Prime generals, friends, are not made of jewel swords and mustache wax. They are made of what is there and what is here.
You're mad.
Mad? Mad. Hannibal was mad. Caesar was mad. And Napoleon surely was the maddest of the lot. Ever since time began, they've called mad all the great soldiers in this world. Mad? You shall see what wisdom lies within my madness. For this is but the spring freshet that precedes the flood. From here we roll on. From village to town. From town to mighty city. Ever mounting. Ever widening. Until at last my wave engulfs all India.
A huge workout for the timpani drums in Rudyard Kipling's Gunga Din, brought to screen there. And, of course, it is maybe the classic imperial moment, the British Raj. But, Jack Peaty, here we are, 2002, and the word imperialism and the notion of a world-ruling power is very much back in currency, right off the screen and in the halls of power.
It certainly is. There's even a group in Washington that I think that practically calls itself the New Imperialist League. And there are articles, you see them in the Wall Street Journal, there was one in the Financial Times the other day, about the Americans need now to go on from Iraq, conquer Syria, conquer Iran, set up decent governments there, straighten out Lebanon while we're at it, and in general just kind of bring back a sort of temporary, a generation or two, imperialism to show these people how to live and to get rid of the terrorism there. These people are acting as if the reality of that, what that man was saying in the film, hadn't happened. They're acting as if nationalism hadn't happened, that the 20th century hadn't happened. You don't go around controlling other people's countries in the 20th century. And if we found out anything, and I hope we don't find it out in Iraq, it's even people who are oppressed by their own governments turn out to defend their governments when they're attacked by foreign powers.
But in a globalized world, Jack, is it still imperialism, or is it just peacekeeping? Is it security-mindedness? Is it just the appropriate kind of policing of peace in the world?
That's the view from the empire, I suppose. I don't expect the people whose national dignity would be crushed would subscribe to that view.
Yeah, just to interject here for a second. I mean, I go back to what Brian Keith was saying in Wind in the Line. He's using a rationale, and I'm seeing a lot of those same rationales being voiced currently that I've seen in other films. And I think that we may put a different name on it. We may not call it imperialism. We may call it cultural imperialism or something like that, but we're still doing the same thing. We are trying to force our will through some sort of political means on another people.
And yet we're told there are weapons out there. It's a whole new day. It's not like it used to be. That weapons of mass destruction and a globalized world, we have to do things differently. Hollywood's camera has gone right into the Middle East, famously in David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia, talking about imperial settings. Garen Daly, here's a classic that goes straight at the subject.
It goes straight at the subject. Lawrence of T.E. Lawrence was an incredible leader. He took and grabbed a hold of that nationalism that was latent in the Middle East.
Arab nationalism.
And I think it's interesting we should also note here something what Jack was saying before. You know, we talk about how Eurocentric this all is. We talk about the Near East, the Middle East, and the Far East, all from Europe. So our viewpoint is very Eurocentric. But T.E. Lawrence and Lawrence of Arabia grabs that latent Arab nationalism, runs with it in World War I, conquers and kicks butt all over the place, takes over Damascus. But at the end of the film, all the good stuff is sold out with a pen when the big guys get together, the interest of money and the interest of government get together and decide what's going to happen and not care about really what is happening to the people.
Never mind Arab nationalism.
Forget about Arab nationalism. And the scene is between Claude Rains and Alec Guinness when they start talking about that.
The world is delighted at the picture of Damascus liberated by the Arab army.
Led, may I remind you, sir, by a British serving officer.
Ah, yes. But then Orange is a sword with two edges. We are equally glad to be rid of him, are we not?
I thought I was a hard man, sir.
You are merely a general. I must be a king.
Excuse me, sir.
Well?
It seems we're to have a British waterworks with an Arab flag on it. Do you think it was worth it?
Not my business. Thank God I'm a soldier.
Yes, sir. So you keep saying.
You, I suspect, our chief architect of this compromise. What do you think?
Me, Your Highness? On the whole, I wish I'd stayed in Tunbridge Wells.
Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean's film, and there the sellout of T.E. Lawrence's struggle for the local people, for Arabs and Arab nationalism. We're talking tonight about imperialism on the silver screen. Is the beginning always idealism and glory, and is the end always grief and raw power? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, thanks.
I just want to say, I guess when you watch these movies, especially like The Man Who Would Be King with Sean Connery and Michael Caine, which is a great movie, but you sort of like feel guilty for rooting with these guys because, you know, they don't represent the best aspects of European culture. And it's sort of like rooting for the Confederate troops in a Civil War movie.
I know exactly what you mean. There's a moment in The Man Who Would Be King where Sean Connery turns to the local men that he's training in soldiery, and he says, "When we're done with you, you'll be able to stand up and slaughter your enemies like civilized men." Well, Michael, that's not exactly not exactly what we're hoping we're rooting for, is it?
Well, you know, I guess the best imperialism movie is the uniquely American imperialism manifest destiny movie, Little Big Man, with Dustin Hoffman, and just shows the absolute absurdity of what can happen when people get mixed in with that kind of stuff.
But you're right, and I can hear your voice, and we've all felt it. There's the temptation, though the Little Big Man makes it very hard, but to root for the imperial power, because after all, here we are, we're sitting in the hemisphere, the continents that benefited from that power, that filled their bank accounts and drawing rooms with souvenirs from all that.
No, it's sad. You know, we're basically standing on a mountain of a lot of other dead people, and what do you do about it? You know, people talk about reparations, people talk about, you know, giving aid and things like that, and I don't know, I guess we can't go back to, like, you know, 1642, whatever it was, and we just have to move on, I guess. I don't know.
You know, but it's always been that way. You go back to Charlemagne. Charlemagne did the same thing. I mean, the word slave comes when he enslaved the Slavs and made them the force to work in his salt mines. I mean, it's been part of the geopolitical scene since day one.
And Garen Daly, I mean, you know the movie world so well. It's not only in the category of imperialism that the viewer is invited to root for. Very often, the powerful, even if the powerful is not correct.
It goes the same way with horror films. How many people were rooting for Hannibal Lecter and Hannibal? I mean, we sometimes really like the bad guy, and it depends on how the camera uses itself and what the literature is being developed and the screenplay and the shot selection. They can really manipulate you.
But on balance, Jack Beatty, what do you think we take away from Hollywood and the silver screen? You know, are we on Rambo's side or not?
Well, of course, it plays with our sympathy. I mean, the star, the close-up, the brawn, all the good lines. And we rarely get a movie that puts the other side first. That's why a movie like The Battle of Algiers is so, for many people, eye-opening.
Suddenly
we see, yes, indeed. The movies really are a classic form of what Edward Said called Orientalism. The way we in the West have misprisoned the East, the way we have used it as an exotic background for our adventures, the way we have sort of seen it as dusky maidens, all the cliches, and you can hear them now just talk into talk radio on AM, and you can hear them all: shiftless people, dusky maidens, virgins.
You heard nobilies. Dusky maidens on commercial talk radio, Jack?
Well, you know, the equivalent.
Okay.
What's going on under those veils? It's all there. And these movies have sort of tutored us in this condescension that is Orientalism.
Ronak is on the line. Welcome, Ronak. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, firstly, I would like to say that I greatly admire Shekhar Kapoor for making this movie. It takes a little bit of guts to come out with movies showing the imperialism
Ronak,
about it.
Ronak, turn your radio off. We can barely make you out.
Firstly, I would like to say that I admire Shekhar Kapoor for making such a movie with the topic on the bad side of imperialism and colonization.
This is Four Feathers.
Specifically my grandfather told me he was imprisoned for being in a peace march And not many people know that such things used to happen during the colonization period.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I would like to point out that while we do admire such movies being made, why are still countries participating in Commonwealth Games? Are we still glorifying the fact that these countries were ruled by Britain and let's get together and have some games?
Well, there's another example, and we hear the sound of India in your voice, but the Commonwealth is still there. The legacies of the imperial age are still very much evident in the world. Hollywood as well, the fact that in the year 2002, Four Feathers is being made, and from all the clips I've seen in advance, this is a film that's relishing all the trappings of imperialism.
It is relishing in that, and it is a trend. And let's go back to what really started it again, and that's Gladiator. Gladiator brought back that epic that had been lost from Hollywood for a number of years, mm-hmm. and Four Feathers is just a continuation of that. And over the course of the next 2 years, we're going to see a lot more of these kind of epic films that Hollywood used to make, the sword and sandal kind of things. These kind of, you know, imperialistic films are going to be coming out. They're in production now. We'll see them in about a year.
But we read in the Times about Four Feathers that here this is not much of an improvement on the attitude behind Beau Jest, 1939, that the desert is a place for Western outcasts, misfits, or mystics, and that the swarthy fellows in white sheets will forever play their parts by attacking the fort and expiring with the blood-curdling cries of the heathen.
Well, you know what the sad thing about all this is that if you have a solid knowledge of the history of film and you've seen films since day one, you know that this is the same thing. But unfortunately, what's happening in Hollywood right now is that the core audience has not seen these films, and they are getting a first taste of it. And I expect that Four Feathers is going to do very well at the box office this opening weekend, and that most of the people are going to enjoy the action, and the people like Heath Ledger and Kate Hudson are going to enjoy the film, even though the themes and the things that are being said there are old and very, very out of date.
Jack Beatty, are you ready for more red jackets and pith helmets?
Well, yeah, and yet in some ways it's very it's really in vogue because, of course, the figure the British are pursuing there is the Mahdi, who is a descendant of Osama bin Laden. He was the jihadist of his day. He said, rise up against these European powers, cleanse the land of them, all the things that bin Laden is saying today. But, you know, about these movies and their appeal, what does it say? That Hitler's favorite movie was Lives of a Bengal Lancer.
It says, sharpen your spear point and then burn the spear.
Yes, it does.
We're talking tonight about imperialism on the silver screen, about Hollywood on the ambition and overreach, the grandeur and the gore of imperialism. What movie moment defines imperialism for you? The triumphs of the thin red line, or Brando upriver and the horror? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about imperialism on the silver screen, about Hollywood on the ambition and overreach, the grandeur and gore of imperialism. What movie moment defines imperialism for you? And are we different now from the clattering Hollywood brigades charging off to distant wars? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by our On Point movie maven, Garen Daly, by our news analyst, Jack Beatty. And let's take a moment now just to listen back-to-back to the kind of the dying embers of the thrill of the imperial here, back-to-back from Apocalypse Now, the thrill and the nightmare of imperialism.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb for 12 hours when it was all over, I walked up. We didn't find one of them, not one stinking dink body. That gasoline smell, the whole hill smells like victory.
When imperialism stopped being fun, upriver with Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now and the famous The Horror. Jack Beatty, Joseph Conrad knew the setting well. Apocalypse Now, we know, taken straight out of his work, out of his Africa, and transported to Vietnam.
Heart of Darkness, yes. Conrad called imperialism a vile scramble for loot, and he saw it close at hand in the Congo, where he worked as a steamboat captain on the river. And he saw the slavery that the emperor of the Belgians, Leopold, was inflicting on the people of that region, carnage beyond and cruelty beyond imagination, and he takes the story to the end where Kurtz, the Belgian, he's almost a missionary. He comes out, Conrad says, as an apostle of pity and progress, and having all that power out there in the jungle with no one to check him, he becomes a monster. And Conrad is saying something there. He's saying, look what high ideals can come to when you have unchecked power.
Jim is on the line. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air. Hello, Jim. Are you there? I think we've lost Jim. Let's turn to another call. We have Jason calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Well, thanks.
I think it's interesting that you're talking about imperialism today. Not to make this too political, but I was listening to the...
Oh, what the heck? What the heck? Go on.
What the heck? Well, I will do my best to tie this into your subject because I think it is relevant. You mentioned Rambo as a sort of modern-day imperial iconoclast. I was listening to the Senate hearings today about possibly invading Iraq. I heard for the first time in this debate the term liberation of Iraq, which I hadn't expected to hear, quite frankly, and I was surprised how easily our country, even in this day and age, embraces these what I think amounts to an imperialistic ideal. At the source of it is, you know, our capitalism, our Christianity, but the whole idea that now this is not a war, they're trying to sell the idea that this would not be a war against a tyrant, but rather a war that can be justified in the sense of liberating people.
But isn't it intended as liberation from tyranny? And is that the same as imperialism, Jason?
Well, I think it is, because imperialism, you know, at our core, we all want to be moral, so imperialism requires a moral center to operate from. And it's not enough to say that, I mean, look, if we told the outright truth and said, well, this is all about securing our oil interests, that doesn't really go over so well in a country that considers itself pretty altruistic.
If we end up, it feeds
right into our imperialistic ideal.
Jason, if we end up in Iraq, how do you think that will be presented in future films?
Well, it's interesting because even a movie like Three Kings, which is I thought it was quite a good film. Even it didn't provide quite a sympathetic appraisal of America's role in Iraq.
And this is George Clooney, Ice Cube, mm-hmm. Mark Wahlberg on a lunge for loot in the Gulf War.
Exactly, and what more? You know, that it reminded me of Kelly's Heroes. I mean, you know, this is a contemporary imperialist film, but this is one that is sympathetic towards our failings in the Gulf War, and that was a war we won and won with few casualties. I tend to think that we will be seeing more Apocalypse Now style movies based on the any intervention we take in Iraq rather than movies like Saving Private Ryan even reflect brutality of war. But I rather think that the history, just judging by the language that is being used to justify our military adventure, I tend to think that history will not be entirely sympathetic to us.
Jason, thank you for your call. It's all about, isn't it, Ghirardelli, the way these adventures turn out. They turn out wonderfully and a great victory, and the movies will celebrate them. They turn out dark and with too much death, American death in particular, and they'll be bemoaned.
That's right. And one of the things we always have to remember about Hollywood is that Hollywood is rarely a leader. Hollywood is a follower, and they will follow whatever is the country's mood and try and capitalize on it and make money out of it.
Jack, if this should go according to the kind of new imperialist plan, and what we get here is a democratic Iraq up on the straight and narrow, the Middle East following along behind, are we in for a new era of God and country movies?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think it's very hard for Americans to accept that power can be as good as our government claims it is. And I just subscribe to what that young man, what that gentleman just said a moment ago,
Jason.
That we can be tremendously high-minded, but let's not forget that ExxonMobil and Halliburton and all the rest are right at the center of this stuff.
Otis is on the line. Welcome, Otis. You're on the air.
Thanks. That's first-time caller.
Good to have you, Otis.
Thank you. Well, I thought about the whole thing about imperialist movies, and I came up with one that's kind of a curve, Wall Street.
With Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
Greed is good.
Yeah, because if you think about it, I mean, like you said, monetary imperialism, same kind of thing. And, I mean, greed is good translates into virtually every language, you know? So I'll just hang up now and just hear what you guys are going to say about it.
Well, can we take it all the way into the halls of capitalism? I mean, are we blending too much together here, Jack?
Maybe so. But what's interesting there is there you get the young man who's initiated into this thing and who sort of wakes up and sees what it's like. And I can imagine a pretty good anti-imperialist movie that would show that, you know, a young man full of enterprise who gets in over his moral head.
But the difference here, though, is not we're talking about individuals here and a corporation. We're not talking about a country forcing its political will on somebody else. And that's the difference.
That's right.
I think the themes are the same, and I think you can draw the same arc, but it is different.
Larry's on the line. Welcome, Larry. You're on the air.
Great conversation, you guys. I was just thinking the anti-imperialist movement and the greatest movie franchise of all time, which would be Star Wars. George Lucas blended all of this together with the commerce, the industry, and his inoffensive universal religion of the Force that no one had to, like, you know, pick sides with.
So, Larry, as Star Wars has progressed or regressed, I'm not sure what you call it, given it's going forward and backward, who is the United States now, the Empire or the noble rebel?
Well, the thing that got me from the last Star Wars movie is here are the clones. If you saw the movie, there's droves of them marching in form. Here they are coming in to save something. And so where does that put us? You know, where are we the people who are striving to save save from the evil empire?
Well, that's what we're told we are, and Americans clearly would like to be. Garen Daly?
And the thing is that we can project forward into Episode 3 that the clones are going to be the undoing of the Republic, and the Empire is going to be taking over. So I think there's a double edge there.
Larry, thanks for your call. I want to get one more quick call. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Well, my contribution or my thought when you asked about the first movie that came to mind about American, or at least imperialism as an American, for me was Sand Pebbles. I saw it as a young adult.
Steve McQueen, excellent film.
Oh, excellent movie.
We remember it well. We're almost out of time, but Mike, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, a last word from Rudyard Kipling?
A last word. Well, of course, there was a double side to this. Empires crashed, and on the occasion of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897, he wrote, "Far called our navies melt away on dune and headland sinks the fire. Lo, all our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre. Judge of the nations, spare us yet, lest we forget, lest we forget."
Rudyard Kipling. Always laying down the last word on imperialism. Garen Daly, it's been a pleasure going through the movies with you tonight.
This has been a lot of fun.
Four Feathers opens tomorrow.
Yeah.
Shall we be there? Or is it this imperialistic?
There's some great scenes in it, but ultimately it just doesn't deliver.
Yeah, so maybe not the charge of the Light Brigade. Garen Daly is owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. And Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums.
12 valiant saints, their hope they knew and mocked the cross and flame. He met the fire.
In a moment, one of France's most notorious war criminals is released from prison. We hear from the daughter of one of his victims. This is On Point.
His death to feel.
It was Maurice Papon's signature that consigned more than 1,500 Jews to their deaths in Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War. Yesterday, the 92-year-old Mr. Papon, one of France's highest-ranking civilian war criminals, was released from prison. He'd served just 3 years of a 10-year sentence. Colette Gutmann witnessed Popon's release. The 61-year-old Parisienne's father died at Auschwitz. She spoke earlier with On Point producer Kelly Jones, who interprets her remarks in tonight's diary.
Je suis la fille d'un homme qui s'appelait Simon Gutmann.
I'm the daughter of a man who is named Simon Gutmann and who was deported, rounded up in the mass arrests of July 1942. As for me, I escaped because at the time of the July 1942 raids, it was against the law to take children younger than 2 years old, and I wasn't old enough, so they didn't take me or my mother. That leaves my father, who was first sent to Drancy, then to Auschwitz, and he died 21 months later, that is, when he was barely 30. Yesterday I woke up and heard on the radio that Maurice Papon was being let out of prison for health reasons. Now, I live next to the prison, so that makes things easy. When I heard that, I felt, I don't even know how to describe it, I felt such a pang in my stomach, like when you're faced with something truly awful, when you come face to face with death or sheer terror. Call it a metaphysical pain, if you will. It was awful. And I told myself, I'm going to see what happens. I arrived in front of the prison, and I saw a throng of police and journalists, and no one else. And that tells me that it had been done quickly, so that people wouldn't be able to come because they'd be at work, and so there wouldn't be any demonstrations. That alone is shocking.
On s'est retrouvé à peu près à trois personnes, moi qui venais volontairement, et deux autres qui passaient dans la rue.
And so there were just the three of us, I, who was there by choice, and two people who happened to be walking by and wondered what was going on. I told them, Papon is getting out, and they stayed. And they were absolutely, they didn't know. No one knew. That was when something strange occurred to me. It was that seeing all of this activity, all of this really technical stuff, the police were doing their work, the journalists were doing theirs, chatting with each other, joking, all that. And I was comparing that to the significance of what was happening. What I mean is, it wasn't just anything that was happening. This was a man guilty of crimes against humanity, and he was about to get out, and everyone was just hanging out, chatting. Seeing all that, I just started to bawl my eyes out. I cried inconsolably, like a baby. I made so much noise. Really, I was so embarrassed. I didn't know what to do with myself. Everyone was looking at me. Finally, I managed to stop crying, and I approached. I waited for the right moment, and that's when I saw Papon's attorney. He was just so full of himself, triumphant, so happy there in the sunshine, smiling. Triumphant. He had just made his career, really accomplished something he'd been fighting for a long time, that would put him on the top. And then he did something I couldn't believe. He plunked himself right down in front of all the television cameras, took a piece of paper from his pocket, held it up, and he said, "Here it is, the last paper I'll ever have to file for my client. I won't be needing this anymore. He's free." And I found that so over the top, so cynical, so unconscionable, that I couldn't resist. I had to say something. And I said, "It's your big day. You must be very proud. We're all so grateful, all of us, the children of the deported. We're very grateful."
Vous devez être très fiers et nous vous sommes tous reconnaissants. À peu près, enfin, tous les enfants déportés, nous vous sommes tous très reconnaissants.
That was Colette Gutmann, daughter of World War II deportee and death camp victim Simon Gutmann. She spoke earlier from her home in Paris with On Point producer Kelly Jones, who interpreted her remarks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WBUR.